Up next, I got a piece for you here. It's a good long piece, but a good informative piece. So if you got that cup of coffee or that cup of tea there, just settle in and listen to this, because this is very interesting. The voices of Arab feminists have come together in an anthology packed with insights on the themes of home and homeland, exile, feminism, borders, gender and sexual identity, solidarity, language, creative resistance, and colonization. The CKUT News Collective attended an intimate book launch recently held in Montreal. We're about to listen to a snapshot of presentations from the mouths of contributors themselves, followed by a discussion on some salient themes. We're going to hear the voices of, and forgive me if I don't pronounce the names correctly, we're going to hear the voices of Khada Shehadeh, Nehruz Abu Hatoum, Maha Zimo, and followed by remarks from co-editors Haida Musa and Hadir Malek, as well as a broad exchange of ideas. So, enjoy.
Dark and glistening from the olive oil, my mama used to bathe me in at night. I am an Arab woman, orientalized through colonial eyes. I am an Arab woman, understood out of context, like a tale from an ignorant mind. I am an Arab woman. You invade my land in the name of my liberation, when I know that all you want to bring are my children's enslavement and indignation. You may think me oppressed, but take a look at your precious West. My sister's work and all their worth are dismissed every hour. And for the record, tell me, white man, how many women do you have in power? I have been mysticized and exoticized, criticized, and even demonized. See, you can't decide. Am I part of your harem dream? Or is my movement too extreme? For 500 years of incursion and oppression have taught me some brand new moves. And my movements speak like words that need no translation. I roll them from my lips down to my wide breathing hips. Liberation, liberation for the emerging Arab nation. So colonizer, while you may want to save me so that you may own me, I tell you instead you should fear me. Because inside of me there is an army. And we are dark and glistening and proud to be born. And we chant, liberation, liberation for the emerging Arab nation. We are Arab women.
So I wrote this almost 3 years ago. So things always change in the Middle East and in the context of Palestine specifically, but now the whole Middle East. So, but anyways, the same ideas, it's interesting to see like how same concepts and same levels of violence haven't really changed. But I do feel some distance already to this piece. So I'll choose something that it's a little bit less ethnographic. So it's page 138. It's called Trajectories of Crossings. In the spring of 2012, I drove to the north of Palestine, the land that is ruled by the Israeli state. It only occurred to me then that one could enjoy the beauty of the land while detaching it from the name of the state which rules the land. When this realization happened, I finally accepted the landscape as part of me. Even though many Israelis walk the land to mark it as their historical lineage, they cannot mark it as such in my visual perception, let alone my imagination. This somehow sums up the sentiments that many Palestinians citizens of Israel experience in relation to the presence of the state in their lives and the absence of their presence in the state. That day, I learned that that even though the state doesn't contain me, the land will always do. In the spring, the land in northern Palestine wears a beautiful green, yellow, and red gown of bloom that could almost smoothly conceal any border anxiety. In a space where the land is heavily marked by military borders with landmine-infected fields. From afar, I could see the Lebanese flag drawn on a top of a tower in a village on the other side of the border. The distance between the flag and me seemed so small. Ramyat Hajar in Arabic, stone throw away. A fluid conceptualization of distance that rarely predicted political limitation. As Palestinian citizens of Israel, we cannot visit Lebanon, Syria, or Iraq. Lebanese, Syrians, or Iraqis cannot visit us either unless they carry European or North American passports, although even then they could be denied by entry by Israel. Trains carrying people, ideas, or goods between Beirut, Haifa, Damascus, Baghdad, or Cairo were blocked with the creation of Israel over 65 years ago. I'm just going to move to 147, where I talk about borders, borders as mourning sites. In Arabic, the word for border is hudud, deriving from the root hadda. The verb hadda in Arabic holds multiple meanings depending on the context it is used. The verb means to draw borders between one thing and another, to sharpen a knife, to mourn the death of a relative, or to discipline or halt someone from doing something wrong. The relationship between drawing a border and disciplining bodies is a significant one. It implies two interpretations. The first assumes that disciplining is drawing a border between the subject and his or her presumably wrong behavior. The second implied meaning suggests that borders are an act of disciplining. To border someone is to discipline him or her. I suggest that the two meanings are complementary. Borders are disciplining entities, and on a material level, they halt people from continuing their journey on this land. And on an abstract level, as in the social level, meaning confinement to border prevents people from breaking their own social boundaries that restrict them to live and perform within rigid social structures, gender dichotomies, national or racial or class segregations. The word for border and the word for mourning in Arabic share a similar root. While it may seem that the relationship between the concept of mourning and borders is arbitrary, I suggest engaging with this terminological proximity in an empirical sense, which might give us a hint to this form of relation. Within the context of colonized lands or countries that are torn by war or divided by borders, border zones become sites for mourning, the death of the lost or absent ones. In The Locust and the Bird, my mother's story, Lebanese author Hanan Sheikh narrates the story of her mother's neighbor in a village in South Lebanon, whose daughter disappeared in one of the Israeli invasions of the South. The neighbor would go to the border between Lebanon and Israel every day and mourn the disappearance of her daughter by crying loudly and calling her name across the border. The relationship between border and mourning can also be drawn in Joe Sacco's Footnotes in Gaza, a graphic novel. Journalist Joe Sacco conducted a lengthy research on the 1956 Israeli massacre in Gaza through reading Israeli military archives as well as interviewing Palestinians in Gaza about the massacre. He documented stories he heard from people in Gaza about women who lost their beloved ones in the massacre. These women would go to the Rafah-Egypt border to perform mourning rituals by crying, hitting themselves, and throwing sand on their bodies. And it's called Maltama in Arabic. Women mourn the death of their family members on the border, even though the massacre happened away from the borders. Across the northern borders of Palestine lies a continuous of historical territory of Bilad al-Sham, the land that shares most of its linguistic, environmental, cultural, and social characteristics with Palestine and the Palestinians. Over 6 years of dispossessions, displacement, disconnections turned the borders into sites of heavy anxiety mixed with melancholic memories. The occupied Syrian Golan Heights, north of Palestine, have been cut from the rest of Syria for the past 45 years. Syrians in the Golan have been prohibited from easy flow of movement from Julan to Syria. Julani women and men who marry Syrians are forced to move to Syria without an option of return. This situation has created a ghost of exile that haunts the border between Julan and the Syrian state since 1967 occupation. Julanis have made one border zone in the village of Majd al-Shams as a communication site with their families across the border. Today, that area is called the Shouting Valley, Tellit al-Sayhat. Speaking through megaphones, Syrians from both sides of the border communicate their family stories, pass their longings through, and wave with flags or white handkerchiefs, perhaps to enhance the visibility or presence from that distance. Memories are made and shared in the Shouting Valley. They are spelled out to meet with echoes across the other side, which shouts back, answering the questions before they're even asked. Perhaps borders are fertile grounds for memories to flourish, making memories not only temporarily, but also spatially conditioned. My great-grandfather, as my grandmother boasted, had so much land and properties that he could afford lung surgery in Beirut. The doctors there, my grandmother continued, were the best in the world. He then lived years over years with one lung in his body in Palestine and another one he left buried somewhere in Beirut. I wonder if my great-grandfather ever thought that none of his third or fourth generation of descendants could even cross these borders back and forth, because those who crossed it as refugees in 1948 never came back. Thank you.
So, I am the little one with head shaped like a potato. The beautiful woman holding me is my patrilineal grandmother. The unamused and slightly stunned expression on my face is also why I have my hands angled awkwardly. I had been ripped from my playtime in the sand so that the taller people could pose with my little self. In the video from which I stole this image, I'm waving my paws around because they are dirty. And even then, I did not wish to be improper and run sand across my grandmother. Standing by the Mediterranean's winter coastline at Gaza in approximately 1980, my family had decided that pneumonia at the hands of frozen sea spray was a welcomed family event. Not sure if any of us became bedridden after this shoot, but I can confirm that the video is further proof that I was an addled child, displaying clear signs that I would later become an addled adult. Clearly on pageant is a behavior which I carry with me still, and it's probably why I have a blog. Watching others like a true creep and playing alone with what appealed to me only with neither interruption nor direction from anyone else. I appear quiet, though Mama tells me this has never been the case. As always, I sat alone, either chattering animatedly to myself or singing noise with my imaginary friend, Mark. Shortly after the above photo, my mama locked me between her legs to fasten a poncho around my neck, a poncho I still have today, though too small to wear except as a hat or interesting sleeve. She is struggling with me, and before she has a moment to catch her breath upon my release, I have made like an ostrich and dived headfirst for the sand while simultaneously whipping the poncho back to fashion a noose for my neck. Rula, my eldest cousin, is hell-bent on outdancing Mirfet Amin. And if you don't know her, you have to YouTube her. One of the most popular belly dance stars in the history of the Middle East. Every time she spies herself in frame of the camera's eye, she begins to undulate her little hips while twisting her wrists in an attempt to open invisible doors, leading her to greener pastures. I imagine, away from occupation. While she does this, I'm crouched and playing in the sand, looking shell-shocked as I stare up at her in wonder. Unaccustomed to the belly dancing, movements like incense burning off of cord sticks. She was my heroine and truth-sayer, behind whom I trailed as often as possible while on our trips to Gaza, and I imagine that when I meet her soon, beneath the olive tree, very little will have changed in this equation. The elder women are standing guard over us as my uncle videotapes our trip to the sea. He remains an excellent records keeper. And as I watch, I think how grateful I am for such technology. Though years have passed, this is us only hours ago. In 30 years, this will still be us only hours ago. I am fascinated by three generations of women, led by my grandmother, who is standing strong in a beautiful woolen dress, matriarch over all. She has dimples when she smiles, something I had not noticed until now. My grandmother, who lost her eldest son, there's my trick, in his early 20s, and who continues to create a space of peace and harmony in a world of war and terror, because she, like all other women who reside and function in a state of endless war, has perfected the ability to really and truly create her own sense of insulation, constructed of pure steel. It is this very core which allowed her to build a sanctuary of love amidst supremacist hate, one of her many gifts to us. It is also this core which strikes me as I watch the video, because in her dimpled laugh, there is no reflection of what she lives daily. And perhaps this is the key to living in a constant state of fear, to shrug it off without hesitation. While for those of us who reside beyond its immediate grasp, there is always the fear that it will catch us one day. There's also my mom, there beneath a thick coat, popping up from the sand with hair a mess, laughing wildly and playing alongside the children. And Camilla, my uncle's wife, whose elegant features appear cut from a Roman bust. She stands quiet and strong as the wind renders her striped scarf the perfect frame for her beautiful face. Finally, there is us children, myself, Rilla, and my young boy cousins. We are little children staggering toward the sea, crying, pointing, arguing, falling, laughing, burying our hands into each other's completely and totally innocent to all that would displace us to 2014. We are told to stand in a line so that photos might be taken, and I am the only one who keeps vanishing from frame to play with the sand. In vain, I keep watching to figure out what the fuck I was doing. The magnum opus that required so much attention and determination. Sadly, it was nothing. Actually and literally nothing. Instead, it appears that I am broken record and saucer-eyed, running my hands through the sand over and over and over, creating space in sand like a lunatic petting for some elusive treasure that I had imagined. Maybe the point there is not that I was in search of something, but rather that I have always best been satiated by the journey itself. Though I must admit that this journey is not one I could have dreamed while this video was being filmed. Instead, it has been a journey of divorce, death, occupation, exile, war, false prophets, intifadas, and Arab Springs. We are one generation imprisoned in Libya, another in occupied Gaza, and a third free, but apart in Canada. Watching, I remembered that these women have not come together for over 30 years. This video reminded me. This year, my grandmother turned 85. I remember that I have not laid eyes on her beautiful face since she was 75. That I have not felt her soft hands since she was 75. Have not tasted the almonds and cashews over which she prays regularly. I remember that since then she has not made me her sweet chai nor her bitter coffee, and I have not eaten at her table. I remember that since she was 75, I have not found the hidden chocolate boxes filled with her jewelry, nor have I sat at her vanity smelling her dozens of perfumes and lipsticks, a habit I carry as an adult woman. My grandmother turned 85 this year. I have not, since her 75th, sat with my cousins in her kitchen and laughed at our own hysterical and very poor imitation of our elders, only to be set quiet by the sound of the morning call to prayer. Vividly, I was reminded that since the age of 29, my forehead and eyelids have not felt my grandmother's lips telling me that I am my father's daughter, telling me that I am hers. Seated, I watched repeatedly, caught by a laughter which broke a part of my heart and set it adrift until it jammed itself into my throat. There is heartbreak to face that I have not felt the Mediterranean Sea wash itself over my body. And recalling how I have not asked Rilla questions about the afterlife, a source of extreme angst throughout our young conversations, on par with whether Tom Jones, he of What's Up Pussycat, seriously, I'm not joking, would like us were he to meet us. Most definitely there is sorrow to watch the wildness of my mum and realize that that release, of which I see so very little today, is only tangible when she sits at her computer to Skype with her family in occupied Gaza. I am a woman with feet firmly planted on shifting religious, national, and ideological lands. Displacement, even when voluntary, makes many of us not whole, forced to shape our own identities, our own realities, not of one world or another, but of both worlds as they touch our hearts. I often wonder who I might have been had my parents not immigrated to Canada. Where you'd ask my father, he would say that I would have been a woman without choice, and my right to choose was the primary reason he immigrated. My mother might tell you I would have been a happy mother, now leading a life, though devoid of choice, one that is much more innocent in its surroundings. Me, I imagine that I would be sitting by the sea, typing a lament for far-off lands, wishing to experience what I felt in this moment. I yearn for the fierce winter song of the Mediterranean coastline in Gaza, with my little hands buried deep in the sand and coming up with nothing.
I could say that as soon as this book was on the shelves, it became, for me, both part of a past and a future. And this project, in many ways, is about that overlap, that bridge between the past and the present. Much of my work currently is about how the past is always in the process of returning, but it's also about how reaching for new futures, recognizing the possibilities of that future, or what Leah Lakshmi calls dreaming forward, also involves rewriting our past and thinking about new starting points. And I bring this up for a specific reason, and that's because, in my understanding, pain, or rather the avoidance of pain, is how generation after generation gets stuck, trying to redraw histories, trying to retrace starting points of violence and of mourning, and all of that seems interminable. I keep thinking about what my mother can teach me about a feminism that challenges nationalism, but doesn't turn away from family and community. What Umm Kulthum, for those of you who know who she is, can teach me about love that outlasts distance and war and probably whiskey. About a love that leaves room for grief just as much as passion. It is possible to have more than one starting point, and I'm not searching for fixed origins, but I'm saying that in many ways, some starting points that might allow us to understand ourselves in the world and in relationship to each other have been purposefully erased or brought further and further from our daily lives so that they became alien to us even though they're part of us. How do we retrace these genealogies and lineages when war, colonialism, exile, displacement, immigration, and fear-induced amnesia have worked as one to keep us disconnected? Starting points wrap around our bloodlines and become our lifelines. Some help us breathe and others further suffocate us. Either way, when they change, the story changes. And when the story changes, I think we change. Personally, I'm exhausted of Arab Olympics or oppression Olympics, because when we start there, we forget to speak about the way the story of who is more or less than is fabricated by the same systems we seek to differentiate ourselves from. Why is it that the forces that stopped me, for example, from visiting my family in the Middle East, and the reason I can barely write my name in Arabic, always makes me feel like an imposter? If this book has taught us anything, it's that feeling inauthentic is possibly the most authentic feeling we can feel. So we'd like to offer Minfemi as one of those projects that might allow you to recognize yourself and others, perhaps through questions, even more so than answers. I also hope that for some of you, it allows you to meet yourself and in that sense becomes your own starting point.
In writing this book, for me at least, and I'm sure for Ghaida it could be similar or different, I was thinking of two things. I was thinking of, you know, the audience that I was surprised by when I came to Canada about 11 years ago, that told me, basically, in the mainstream media and people who are unfamiliar with the Arab world, that Arab women are silent, passive, hijab-wearing, oppressed women. And it was surprising to me because looking at the women figures in my life, such as my mother and my grandmother and generations of aunts who have built such a strong ground for me to stand on. That was not the case whatsoever. I could never imagine my mother being the silent, passive woman. Like, if you knew her, that would be ridiculous.
Most Arab women.
Or most Arab mothers. Yeah, so she's not only a strong person in the home, as, you know, someone who's actually brought her life together from leaving Palestine to moving to Jordan and settling in Bahrain, and actually drawn that trajectory of migration to better the lives of her children, but also that she is, a woman who faces the political climate of the region in two folds, because she's a woman. That not only is she facing colonialism and occupation, imperialism and war, but she's also facing patriarchy, which, in my opinion, transcends societies and borders, that it's not just present within the Arab world. When we talk about male or female audience, I think patriarchy impacts everyone, not necessarily just women. And so this book is for a male audience, for a female audience. And I think when we ask about, I mean, to say as well that I've given the book to some of my male friends, and I was quite enthralled by the fact that they've read it and they've come to me to discuss issues of how they've heard from a woman's perspective the experiences that are detailed in this book. And then secondly, the audience for me was my aunts and my mother and my grandmother. And despite the fact that they yelled at me because it's in English and they want to read it in Arabic,
which we're working on,
and I think in the Toronto launch, actually, one of a translator attended our event and translated pieces or parts of our introduction, and I was so happy because I was able to send it to them and they could read it, and they were like, finally, we know what's in the book. But yeah, it's for Arab women. I mean, that's the other audience, and this is the question that I struggle with, is women's writing by women or of women, and, you know, only for women. And I don't think it's only for women. But I think the sad reality is that when we talk about feminism or we talk about women's issues, the majority of men will close their ears unless they themselves question the power dynamic that exists and the sexism that actually exists, and want to open themselves to to challenging those notions. So I think it is open to everyone, and it's a matter of, as I mentioned, finding a connection within yourself to this book and to these pieces, and allowing it to open up further connections.
Thank you.
Do you want to add?
I mean, yeah, I guess so. Like, you have often referred to it as women's writing. For me, the word feminist was important there, because I think beyond it being Arab women speaking, I think there is a man that contributed to the book. The central importance for me was that it was a feminist analysis. And actually, today we were talking about indigenous and women of color feminists before us that have really stressed how the managing of gender, for example, or sexual violence, or other means to control women is so, for example, Andrea Smith in the North American context, is so important to the project of colonialism. So this concerns everyone, because mm-hmm. when, for example, Palestinian women have to give birth on checkpoints, this is everyone's issue, right? For me, I mean, the audience is whoever is willing to acknowledge that, right?
Can I say something?
Yeah, go for it.
Well, actually, my piece is kind of inspired by that, because I think, as a lot of the women here could probably attest to, in my own lived reality, I have a mother and 9 aunts who are all fierce as hell. None of these women are oppressed. None of these women are being beat by their husbands or anything like that. violence against women happens everywhere, right? So I'm not denying that, I'm not disavowing that, I'm not negating that. But the focus in the media for me on this like wholly oppressed Muslim or Arab woman that I didn't see in four different countries that I used to bounce around, visiting family, including here in the Middle East, a lot of it has to do with pretext for oil, intervention, wars, occupation, right? Because if you've ever read Leila Ahmed, she's a really good feminist Egyptian-American scholar in Harvard, and she talks about something, for example, called the Discourse of the Veil, where during British colonial rule of Egypt, you had colonialists saying, well, we have to rush in and liberate these women from the veil because it's super oppressive, mm-hmm. but at the exact same time, they're against female suffrage in England. Mm-hmm. So these anti-feminists, Arab feminists, right, are using this like pretext and the cloak of liberating the Muslim women. And we saw it again with the invasion of Afghanistan. We see it all the time in these like new humanitarian interventions where part of the reason we go in there is to liberate the women, but the women in Afghanistan still wear the burqa. The women in Saudi Arabia, the biggest ally of the US and the West, mm-hmm. are probably the most oppressed and exist under the most, you know, barbaric interpretation of Islam. So I think a lot of it really is geopolitics and interests, and unfortunately women then become tools. They become pawns, right? And so there's genuine interest for female liberation. I don't think they're coming from these areas. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's an agenda.
I just want to add one little point to that, because I agree 100%. I think there is an aspect of human psychology also at play here. It's identifying ourselves by that which we are not. And I think there's an act of willful ignorance. We are the flavor of the 20 blah blahs. What is this technically? 20
first
of our times, 20 teens.
Yeah,
20. Of our time. I think we're just the flavor right now. I don't think we can discount human inclination. Because that sort of idea of oppression and what have you of women, it goes both ways. There are many people in the Middle East who would say to you, women in the West are oppressed. They get their tits cut open so that they can have them stuffed to appease the male gaze. You want to talk to me about oppressed women? Let's talk about that. So I think it is natural human inclination that you actually have to fight. And then I think it's a willful ignorance. The difference being that Arabic women and the political power elite who are making decisions that would frame the discourse in the Middle East are not coming here to take gasoline, right? That's a critical difference. But
I would also add that, like, one thing that we don't hear, so for example, I think the thing that's most unfortunate for me is that amongst ourselves, we can't talk about violence against women,
yes.
right? If this is happening in our communities, we can't talk about it, because as soon as you mention this, you're reiterating something like a discourse that oppresses people, right? That it oppresses family mm-hmm. members and communities. And so I once told Sam, I'm like, you know, would you think the same thing if you knew that someone that could hurt you could hear your thoughts, right? And it becomes
yeah.
this, we can't, you know, the Arab world is fixed in a certain past, and to some extent I think it actually remains in a certain past in the sense that it can't have conversations amongst themselves. And I think one thing that we don't hear, as a side note, is like, okay, so there's violence against women from men, but bombing women and mm-hmm. communities isn't violence, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think there's this quote that I forget who said it, but basically, like, the only way to free women is to bomb them, right? Like,
yeah.
And what is the irony in that? And it's I think, a serious conversation to have, right?
Yeah, and I would say that, as Reda was mentioning, to the process of colonization, I think, you know, it's been said numerous times that if you control the women, you control society. And it's something to think about, I think, as to why it is that women are at the core of this constant processes that end up enslaving us much more than liberating us, as, you know, the West phrases it. Okay, they said and they would come into Iraq to free the women, but they've actually, and free the people from Saddam Hussein, but they've actually resulted in the murder of 10 times the amount of people that have died under that regime. So I think it's important to question those notions of liberation when you're only allowed to be free within a certain context. So you're really allowed to be free. You're only free to be unfree, basically.